Tonight, we're very fortunate to have Ann Madsen with us. I first met Ann Madsen back about 1971 when she was about 13 years old, and we were sharing a Hebrew class together, taught by Ellis Rasmussen here at BYU. The first time I'd met Ann Madsen, it was a wonderful experience. There were only about five of us in the class, as I remember correctly. It's pretty tough when you have to compete with Ann Madsen in a Hebrew class. I won't tell you when she was born, but she did graduate from East High School. She told me not to tell you this, but I'm going to say it anyway. She was president of EHAG. Does anybody know what that is? It's the East High School Association of Girls. She was president of the East High School Association of Girls. She went to the University of Utah and majored in elementary ed because her father wanted her to, and minored in English. She went to the University of Utah, where she majored in elementary ed, and the week after her graduation, she married Truman Madsen, and they moved to Cambridge, or at least Harvard, to work on graduate degrees. They came back here to BYU, and I believe in those days it was religion and philosophy department when he first started, wasn't it, Brother Cowan?
All sorts of things.
No, it wasn't all sorts of things. There were some. Eventually, religion and philosophy separated, and Brother Truman Madsen stayed in the religion part of the two, in philosophy. I'm wrong. Thank you. It's always good to be corrected. I'm used to it at home. Thank you. Anne has taught part-time even for periods full-time and at BYU religion classes. She's taught in the Jerusalem Center even before she and her husband went over to be the directors of the Jerusalem Center in 1991. She taught there for a few sessions, different years, in the Jerusalem Center. She has her master's degree here in ancient studies from Brigham Young University, and she's a masterful teacher. She's still teaching classes in case there's somebody here who wants to take an Old Testament class from Ann Madsen or a Book of Mormon class. You teach them both still, don't you?
Isaiah.
And Isaiah. Wonderful. I would recommend it. Ann, we're so happy and delighted to have you here with us. Please come and instruct us.
I think Brother Cowan and I are the oldest teachers in the religion department. I think maybe I'm the oldest and he's not quite as old as I am. I'm excited to be here. It's been a really interesting few weeks living again with Hugh Nibley. Oh my goodness. I've had so much fun. And I would say I'm sorry to be finished, but I'm really quite glad that it's tonight and that we're going to do this together. I think I first met Hugh Nibley when Truman office next door to him in the old Joseph Smith building, starting in fall 1957. We would see each other occasionally, and I didn't know enough to take advantage of any chance meeting to ask a profound question. I was a young mother, busy with two, then shortly three children, and we were out of breath, just out of graduate school, and settling into our first real house, a tract home, which seemed like a castle to me, with no furniture, but the best hi-fi on the block. We had carpet on the floor as well. My daughter said, "Mom, they won't know what hi-fi is." How many of you know what hi-fi is? See, I knew you'd know what hi-fi was. Truman would come home for dinner and regale me with Nibley experiences almost nightly. Truman knew the treasure that was just through the wall from him. He would say something like, "Nibley knocked on my door today, all excited, and rushed me into his office, waving me away from a chair that didn't sit evenly on the floor so no one could keep him long from his projects." He'd thumb through one of his shoeboxes, pulling out a card here and one there, and then explained in crisp detail a connection he had just discovered gleefully is the only way to describe him, end of quote. So I began to know Hugh Nibley secondhand. After a time, it was easy to see that he was taking my newly PhD'd husband under his wing. He became a kind and generous mentor. Fast forward to 1973, 16 years later. Children, now four of them, in high school and college. I was registered in Religion 606, taught by Hugh Nibley. Do you remember they had, do they still have Religion 606? I called up today when I had finished all of this to see what my grades were. I couldn't stand it. Curiosity of woman, you know. And I got an A minus in 606. I should have had an A, but he said I wasn't organized enough in my blue book at the end. That was Hugh Nibley saying that to me. I knew enough to buy legal notebooks. I brought my notes so that you'd know I honestly did it. And I brought, it has Hugh Nibley First Speaker on Environment series. He had a range of interests. I got legal so that I could write down what Hugh said on one hand and what the class notes were on the other. And I used them as I got working on this project. I was registered in Religion 606, taught by Hugh Nibley, as part of my graduate program in Ancient Studies. My casual acquaintance was about to blossom into full-blown teacher-student relationship. I knew enough to buy the legal notebooks to take notes. Each page was divided so I could take class notes on one and his on the other. This was one of two classes, I think three, when I got my transcript. I took from him, holding out my cup under his Niagara Falls of knowledge, trying to catch all that I could. I sat at his feet. I still do. Reading my class notes a few weeks ago, I could almost hear his voice and see him trotting back and forth, telling us all about everything. I was quite excited to discover that after 34 years of teaching myself in the new Joseph Smith building, I finally understood those notes, most of them. I titled what I'm doing tonight, Hugh W. Nibley and the Bible, quote, "And the Spirit said unto me, look, and I looked." 1 Nephi 11:8. That title seems perfect to me. No one ever looked more earnestly than Hugh Winder Nibley at everything. The scriptures were a major focus all his life. He read them. Discussing his encounter with the Bible is a formidable, let's face it, impossible task, but well worth sampling tonight. Whoever decided to title his documentary The Faith of an Observer hit the nail squarely on the head. In that piece, Hugh said, quote, "We're walking around as strangers, looking for things to recognize. And whenever you see something which you know is good, true, and beautiful, that's an act of recognition. And you recognize it as such, not by analyzing it, but it comes to your memory. It hits you. I've seen that. I know that's right." And so forth. End of quote. He looked. He observed. He pondered. He compared. He recognized. And when he recognized, he wrote to share what he had seen and felt with us, to share his faith. I did not come close to reading all of his writings, teachings, and lectures on the Bible in preparing for tonight. I called up to get a complete list of all the things he'd written. And when I looked at it, I thought, almost everything's about the Bible. How can I say that he wrote this many things about the Bible? And then I was thinking, well, the first thing he wrote that I can find is in 1951. So I'll say it started in 1951. Oh, I don't think so. I think he was probably thinking and writing about the Bible when he was 5 years old, 6 years old, who knows? Anyway, I looked at a lot of it, and I kept bumping into some things over and over again, and looking over my class notes, some of the same themes emerged. These I chose to examine more deeply with you. Just what did Hugh Nibley look at? Mostly, he looked at the big picture, a giant puzzle with thousands of pieces. It was not just a worldview, but a cosmic landscape. After seeing the sweep of it all, he often invested his time in examining some of the smallest details. If you can call the well-known round hypocephalus facsimile number 2 a small detail, he wouldn't have called it small in any sense, as his thick book on it is scheduled to come out on his 100th birthday with the clever title, One Eternal Round. What a guy. Well, don't you find that funny? I think he would have found that so funny. He has more to say, to teach us. Do you know what a hypocephalus is? It is a round disc covered about 7.5 inches in diameter. Some are larger, some smaller. According to my informant, Michael Rhodes, you can turn to page 36 in the Book of Abraham in the Pearl of Great Price to see one. And that's about the size that one was, 7.5 inches. Not in the book, but in reality. One description of how a hypocephalus was used by the ancient Egyptians states that it was a round head cushion covered with writing placed under the head of the mummified person to assist him in remembering what to say and do in relation to questions he would face after death, things he would need to know to be resurrected and go live with the gods. But enough about the small he chose to prize. I stood in the hallway at the university the other day talking to two professors about this, and I thought, I haven't said nearly enough, but I thought, it's probably all you want to know about a hypocephalus, and you can learn a lot more when the book comes out. Number 2, how did he organize his looking? What was his research strategy? What a gold mine I found right under my nose. At least his plan in 1951. And I hope I still have the gold mine. I do. This method likely evolved over the next decades, but what fun to see how he was thinking in 1951. My friend and home teacher, Victor Purdy, fine librarian retired from this university, recounted for me a meeting he attended in March 1951 when Hugh Nibley spoke to the University Archaeological Society. In the words of my friend's journal, quote, "I made sure I showed up for that meeting, and it turned out to be the most memorable. Nibley talked rapidly," does that surprise you, "describing how he went about doing his research. The process involved several steps. First, he would determine the current scholarly interpretive consensus regarding the aspect of the ancient world he was investigating. So we'd find out what the consensus was. Second, he would identify all of the extant primary documents for that period of time. Third, he would arrange the documents in the chronological order of their creation. Fourth, he would read those documents in that chronological order, starting with the older documents. You know they're not all English. They're in several languages. And fifth, he made note of anything in the documents that was counter to the current scholarly consensus." Are you getting this? This is so interesting. He's finding out what everybody else thinks, and then over time, the accumulated anomalies would tend to suggest new interpretations, new patterns. Some of these anomalies would make Nibley aware of new concepts to which he was not originally sensitive, requiring him to go back and reread the earlier documents with a new awareness. That was his modus operandi. Well, he looked for patterns. The Bible presented Hugh Nibley with a very ancient, very big pattern, picture. It traced the life of a family who came to be called collectively the children of Israel. He saw a pattern here. In my class notes, I wrote, patternism. Was this word his invention? We're all tested the same. Each generation has same tests, some more wicked. Moroni 10, all dispensations have a last days. Hugh observed Israel rejecting God in an undulating pattern, a recognizable cycle over and over again. But in the same moment, Hugh would point out to us that even though this persisted, God deigned to give these wandering people power to become his sons and daughters, his peculiar holy people, set apart from the world. Observing these patterns prompted questions, some of them difficult to answer, but needing answers nevertheless. What does this patience with rebellious children teach us about God, about forgiveness, about us, about his hand stretched out still, of which Isaiah repeatedly speaks, about the transforming, enabling power of the atonement? Remember the tender moment in the DVD when Hugh says, quote, "The angels envy us our ability to forgive and repent." That's what it all comes down to. Two things are our final test. Can we forgive and can we repent? He described it as progressive repentance forevermore and a progressive revelation of our own ignorance. I remember in class, it was always so fun. He would say something, and then he would say, "It's a progressive this, and it's progressive that," and then he would say, "Of your own ignorance," you know, and you'd think, ah, he'd just wake us up. Our family memorized his insightful take on rationalization. You can always find someone wickeder than yourself. He probably said more wicked. It may give you a good feeling, but it will block the way to your own repentance. So these are the answers Hugh gave to a couple of the questions. Repent, forgive. Simple, profound. Number four, he looked at temples. The Bible describes temples and their rituals from beginning to end and beyond, often in the minutest detail. Cubits and all, including clothing and vestments and a golden crown etched with holiness to the Lord. Hugh looked hard at biblical temples and rituals and found counterparts all over the world and all across history. If you ever heard him speak or read his words, you had to have come across the phrase something like this: "The temple is a scale model of the universe." Ever hear him say that? In my notes, it says right after that, "Cosmic idea, everything has an appointed time and place." And then, "Temple, a scale model of Zion. Temple, a scale model of cosmos." One profound observation explains what we might call the bottom line. It becomes pointless to draw the line between the world, this world, and the beyond. Indeed, the contemplation of the unbroken continuity of life from eternity to eternity is the very purpose and function of the temple. For him, it all began with Adam and Eve and an altar built by Adam, who knew not why but was obedient to the command. After typing that sentence, it occurred to me that I was not being accurate, since he actually wrote a piece called Before Adam. But I think his biblical look at temples would start with Adam's altar. He said, "My story begins with Adam and Eve, the archetypal man and woman in whom each of us is represented." I think "my" here refers not only to the story he's about to tell, but to his own story. "My story begins with Adam and Eve." From the most ancient times, their thrilling confrontation has been dramatized in rites and ceremonies throughout the world as part of a great creation drama rehearsed at the New Year to celebrate the establishment of divine authority on earth in the person of the king and his companion. End of quote. I was interested to note that patriarchy and matriarchy, from which this quotation came, was a speech first delivered on February 1st, 1980 at the BYU Women's Conference. I didn't remember that he ever talked to the Women's Conference, but he did. And I'm sure I heard him. Which would explain his close look at Eve and her role in the following assessment. You will understand why at least we women love this. Quote, "So who is more important? Eve is the first on the scene, not Adam, who woke up only long enough to turn over and to fall asleep again. And then when he really woke up, he saw the woman standing there ahead of him, waiting for him." He goes on to discuss in detail the interaction between Adam and Eve and the choice to opt for ever greater light. Quote, "The first daring step had to be taken, and if in her enthusiasm she let herself be tricked by the persuasive talk of a kindly brother," in quotation marks, "it was no fault of hers. Still, it was an act of disobedience for which someone had to pay, and she accepted the responsibility. And had she been so foolish? It is she who perceived and points out to Adam that they have done the right thing after all. Sorrow, yes, but she is willing to pass through it." I'm sorry. I didn't ever cry when I read that before. Okay. "Sorrow, yes, but she is willing to pass through it for the sake of knowledge." Knowledge of good and evil. I told you it might be hard to do this. Knowledge of good and evil that will provide the test and the victory for working out their salvation as God intends. End of quote. His explanation is clearly stated, calling on other obvious sources where this vital drama is played out. I think it's fascinating the way he could come right up next to something and tell you something and yet not betray promises he made in the temple not to speak. Moving on to Moses and the tabernacle in the wilderness. In Hebrew, tabernacle is the tent of meeting, a much more accurate idea, which allowed a portable temple to house rituals and a place where the Lord could meet his prophet leader and tent in the midst of his fickle children, Israel, welcoming their sincere sacrifices, but rejecting their meaningless offerings that came from habit, but hardly from the heart. Echoes of Cain and Abel. Another pattern. Another question. What did Satan have to do with all this? Brother Nibley explains, "Satan's concern with Moses was not to turn him against religion, but to enlist his devotion." Interesting thought. In Moses 1, a most marvelous piece of epic and dramatic literature, and no one would know better than Hugh Nibley, who knew a lot of epic and dramatic literature, starting with the Greeks, maybe even before that. A most marvelous piece of epic and dramatic literature, Satan confronts Moses, and Moses doesn't yield. But Aaron does. He falls for Satan's golden calf, end of quote. It all seems to be about enticing and the opposition necessary for man to choose. In Moses' words, having experienced both God and Satan, quote, "Behold, I can judge between thee and God." Moses 1:15. I can judge. What a powerful idea. In the spirit of approaching Zion, let's rush by Solomon's grand ornamented structure. I really like that line. Do you like that line? In this, you all know about approaching Zion. Anybody doesn't know about approaching Zion? Well, you wouldn't admit it, would you? In Approaching Zion, he talks to us a lot about materialism. So now I'll read it again and see if you laugh. In the spirit of Approaching Zion, let's rush by Solomon's grand ornamented structure. Thank you. Double the size of the movable tent of meeting, but with the same rituals and priesthood. Oh, but there was more, much more. that temple destroyed in about 586 BC and rebuilt in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah around 515 BC, a more modest structure, but still a place to carry out the law of Moses, which, as we all know, was based on a system of sacrifice, an eternal type in the biggest picture of all, for the Redeemer of us all. In that same spirit, we will glance at Herod's massive building projects, whose large and spacious building projects included enlarging and beautifying that same Jerusalem temple on the hill across from the Mount of Olives, which was barely finished after decades and destroyed only a few years later by the Romans for the last time in about 77 AD. One of my most memorable experiences in Jerusalem was walking by the light of a full moon one night, tracing Jesus' path across the valley of Kidron to Gethsemane. As we walked beneath the Dome of the Rock, I suddenly realized that when Jesus walked this way on that fateful night before his arrest, there was the same full moon, but the shadow that fell across his path would have been Herod's gigantic white temple. And it was easy that night to picture a white temple in the light of that full white moon. He would have been walking in the shadow of the temple, the one he called his house only days before as he cast out those who defiled it. The destruction of that temple in 77 AD was not the end of Hugh Nibley's ardent research into ritual and temples. As was his wont, he looked outside the box. He found temples aplenty in Egypt and in ancient documents he studied. Ezekiel predicted a future temple. The scribes who penned the Dead Sea Scrolls saw a future temple with an authentic priesthood. All these temples and more deserved Hugh's attention. And so he looked, hoping to find something he recognized, and he did. How did Hugh Nibley respond to our modern temples? He went inside. In the days long ago, when the religion faculty held, when the religion faculty held regular temple nights, he would come to teach us inside the temple. All of us dressed in white, able to speak of things there that we could not discuss elsewhere. Try imagining yourself in the temple, all in white, listening to Hugh Nibley with his white hair, white clothing, and face full of light as he spoke in his wonderful, animated way. He might have said something like this, which was published in Idea of the Temple, so you needn't worry that I'm speaking out of turn. And I'm not in white. Quote, here all time and space come together. The barriers vanish between this world and the next, between past, present, and future. What is bound here is bound beyond, and only here can the gates be opened to release the dead who are waiting the saving ordinances. Here the whole human family meets in a common enterprise. All time becomes one, and the worlds join hands in the work of love, which is no mere mechanical bookkeeping. End of quote. I noticed during all my research that he spoke of the time beyond. It was like, it was a place he was waiting to go. It wasn't a place that was frightening, or it was a place where there was a lot going on, and he wanted to know all about it. When Krešimir Ćosić brought dozens of names of his Croatian ancestors for their temple blessings, Hugh Nibley was always there with Phyllis. So was I. So was Truman. He always went inside with his eyes wide open, looking just like the angel had invited Nephi to do. Number five, I would like to give Truman a moment here. This is the part I might have cried, but I've already done that, so maybe I won't now. He knew him so well. He would have done such a great job of this tonight. Truman used to say, "No one knows what he knows." I can attest to that in all of the ambiguity our language provides. No one knows what he knows. We have no idea the extent of his data bank. No one knows what he knows. None of us have nearly the data bank to draw on that he does. And perhaps most significantly, no one knows what he knows. In other words, the depths of his spiritual nature and experiences are not known to us. We don't have the same lens to see through a glass brightly. You know, after I typed that, I thought, now that sounds like Truman. He always liked to play with words and mix them up. So we don't have the same lens to see through a glass brightly. He routinely brushed so close to the sacred, it was really the center of his study. Some may have thought he said too much. I would question that. He always said too little. There was always more to recognize, to understand. But we lacked the tools. He brushed ever so close, using terms and metaphors that would paint vivid pictures for us, trying to bring us along to where he was. For instance, quote, "We know now that there are three worlds. There is the telestial in which we live and the celestial to which we aspire. But in between them is another world which is called the terrestrial. And that is represented by the temple, according to the ancients." He always did that too. He always blamed it on the ancients. But his blame was always square and true. But in between them is another world which is called the terrestrial, and that is represented by the temple, according to the ancients. It's the in-between world where the rites of passage take place. End of quote. Interesting. It was all one big picture to him, and the temple personified and was the center of it. No one knows what he knows, indeed. There may be more in that little sentence, but that will suffice. 6. Let's discuss his footnotes for a minute. It would be interesting to average out the number in his many articles and books. 19 is the fewest I remember seeing. I wrote that before I had read one article that only had 2 footnotes, which really, I wondered, he must have really been in a hurry that day or something. Or he just didn't tell us all the people he was quoting. 19 is the fewest I remember seeing, and 128 is not uncommon. My sampling was only that. Incidentally, I have 19 footnotes in this 15-page paper. I just, you know, it seemed only fitting. I've heard people say that many footnotes can't all be real, that he must have fabricated some to impress. But I stumbled onto an eyewitness account from someone I trust completely. When our son Barney was in law school, he was a research assistant for Jack Welch and was assigned to check the footnotes for Hugh's fairly short essay, Treasures in the Heavens, to be published in the first volume of the collected works of Hugh Nibley, Old Testament and Related Studies. When he began his task, he noticed the essay took up fewer pages than the footnotes. The final published version of the essay is 17 pages, while the footnotes fill 26 pages. The job looked daunting. He began chasing the books referenced all around the library. They were not conveniently located on adjacent shelves in one area, but scattered all over the library. And Barney said, "Isn't it amazing? I had a list. I could go and find them. But when he was doing the research, he had to go to the places where these things were and get them and read them." He said it must have taken him hours, because it took Barney hours. They were not conveniently located on adjacent shelves in one area, but scattered all over the library. He was impressed by the breadth of the research. No stone left unturned. No computerized card catalog. That's how long ago this was. Barney is now in a stake presidency on campus and a senior partner in a law firm. Soon he recognized that there were almost as many languages as there were books. And while he could handle the German and the French and the English and a few others, He often had to seek out Brother Nibley to get him to translate what he had found. He was impressed at how gracious and kind he always was. It was not long until Barney realized he had his own tool to shortcut the looking. Thumbing through the pages, looking for a page number, he would find the page and in the margins, penciled notations in a hand that he soon recognized as Hugh Nibley's. Talk about researching treasures. I guess he didn't have the librarian I did in junior high, or I think at the library in Salt Lake when I was a little girl, that said, never deface a library book. Never write in a library book. Hugh had written all over in these books, and so Barney could just thumb through, find the notations in the side, and then he knew he was getting close to where the footnote was. When he told me that, I immediately thought that perhaps someone should do a thesis collecting footnote references with their accompanying Nibley notes. Wow, imagine my surprise when I called to consult with Gary Gillum, only to find that he is serving a mission in California, and that the fine young man who was hired to try to fill his shoes, Ryan Combs, is in the midst of just such a project. They are using Twitter and Facebook technology. He describes it thus. We hope to scan the copies of books, this is Ryan Combs. We hope to scan the copies of books Hugh Nibley owned and donated to the library or borrowed from the library and wrote in. I love you, Brother Nibley. We'll start with the books in the public domain and try to add others based on legal copyright. Once we have them scanned, we'll invite professors and students familiar with Nibley's work to contribute to this database, which will be a kind of combination of Wiki and Flickr. And I said, excuse me, what are Wiki and Flickr? And he said, do you know what Wikipedia is? I said, yes, I understand Wikipedia. And he said, well, Flickr, and then he explained it to me, and I've forgotten, because I didn't think I was going to be using it. I might use Wiki. People will be able to tag sections of the page and type what they think Nibley wrote. Someone else can disagree and give their opinion. Another tag will do it is of the text itself. If it's a book Nibley cited in his own writings, we'll tag that section of the book and link it to appropriate publication on the Maxwell Institute website. The tags will be searchable and be a good way for people to research on the shoulders of a giant. Now, how many of you understood all that? There are some of you older people, I bet, that don't. But young people, raise your hands. How many of you understood all that? Does that sound exciting? It sounds exciting, doesn't it? Okay. I was thinking of myself as a young person, but I only understood half of it. Their challenge will be the languages, but then a group of 8 to 10 linguists should be able to do that. What a pity. Hugh is no longer in that ancient studies office on the fourth floor to consult, as Barney had the pleasure of doing. Technology is great, but not the same as knocking on an office door and finding Hugh Nibley willing to confer with you. So what was the verdict of my careful soon-to-be lawyer son? Hugh Nibley did exhaustive research, and the 128 footnotes he checked were absolutely accurate. Okay, can you open that for me? And then I'll just drink right out of it if you get it open. Thank you. He looked at, that's nice, a cup. Thank you. Number 7, he looked at languages and learned them. We needn't number the languages in those little shoeboxes or in his head. The fact is, he kept brushing up on all of them most of the time. In Bible scholarship, we begin with Hebrew and Greek, the languages of the Old and New Testaments. But he ran far ahead of that, learning as he ran. 13-plus languages learned seems to be the consensus, but some report he could read well in 24 languages. Ugh. He always had a question to ask. What indeed is Reformed Egyptian? Has anyone ever answered that satisfactorily? Not to my knowledge. Maybe someone here could do that. One would have to begin with Egyptian, so he mastered Egyptian. My favorite memory of witnessing that expertise was walking with him down the broad hallway into a burial tomb in the Valley of the Kings near Luxor, Egypt. And then I just have to tell you, I remember clearly Truman's amazement when he found that Hugh had never visited Egypt in person, and his immediately making arrangements to correct that. Happily, we were able to walk beside him on that first jaunt. And I use the word advisedly because he was like a child opening an unexpected but perfect gift. I had been to Egypt 3 or 4 times before and walked into its obvious ancient history. What a visual aid for antiquity. This time, Hugh rushed along, translating the walls as he went, finger tracing the hieroglyphics where he could reach, and he was short, so he couldn't reach too high, and pointing where he could not, unlocking as he sped along the meanings of the afterlife according to these ancient people's understanding. I hope someone was recording, but I don't think they were. And I remember thinking, I have died and gone to heaven. I've walked in and out of these tombs and wanted to know what they said, and he's telling me what they say, and we're walking in and he's explaining as we go. You can see some of this. He does some of this in The Faith of an Observer. So take a look at that again, and you'll see him doing a little bit of this. But that wasn't on our trip. That was different, a later trip. The running commentary with us included corrections as he went. He would translate and then correct himself. No, no, he would say. That would be better said this way. That was Hugh Nibley. When he found he was in error, he readily shifted to what he felt was a better fit, more truthful. You get nowhere in scholarship without maintaining a foundation of truth to return again and again after the theorizing. As he examined those tomb walls, there would be connections with our doctrine of the afterlife, and he would point out any overlap he saw. My little experience with Hebrew in teaching Isaiah and Old Testament courses helps me see how very much a language opens a window, letting in much more light. One Hebrew word like Elohim or Derek can change the entire meaning of a verse. The example that I want to give you is Psalm 8, 4 to 5, and maybe you've all heard this many times. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, it says in the King James Version. But the Hebrew word is Elohim. Now, I think most of you know what Elohim means, even though you don't know Hebrew. But a little lower than the Elohim. And the people writing it, translators always have to have their own preconceived notions. They could not put God there. In fact, in the NIV, I think it says something like heavenly beings. But they really just couldn't put Elohim. They couldn't put God. It doesn't bother us, does it? He's made us a little lower than the gods. Imagine Hugh had the ability to look through the lenses of 13-plus languages. How broad was his horizon? How able was he to find connections others might miss or never even know existed? Number 8, he looked at sources beyond the Bible to help recognize what was being taught us in Holy Writ. He was willing to search the Apocrypha, and pseudepigrapha, which we traditionally look to as context for our modern Bible, and which Joseph Smith inquired about as he was working in the Old Testament. Does somebody have a Doctrine and Covenants here? Can I borrow it? Thank you. thank you. I meant to bring my scriptures. I always take my scriptures every place, but I didn't bring them. So it's in yours just like it is in mine. Section 91 is so short that it's not hard to read the whole thing. Joseph Smith was in the midst of translating the Old Testament in 1833. I'm always surprised to see when he got revelations, you know? Some of them say 1829. Got a revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants. Whoa. And he's asking a question. Verily thus saith the Lord unto you concerning the Apocrypha. There are many things contained therein that are true, and it is mostly translated correctly. There are many things contained therein that are not true, which are interpolations by the hands of men. Verily I say unto you that it is not needful that the Apocrypha should be translated. Therefore, whoso readeth it, this is the important verse, let him understand, for the Spirit manifests truth. And whoso is enlightened by the Spirit shall obtain benefit therefrom. And whoso receiveth not by the Spirit cannot be benefited. Therefore, it is not needful that it should be translated. That was kind of a no answer that put in a very nice way. DNC 91.5 could have been written with Hugh Nibley in mind. Whoso is enlightened by the Spirit shall obtain benefit therefrom. He does quote DNC 91 occasionally in his writings. He differentiated between canon and non-canon, but was not afraid to examine ancient myths and traditions, walking around in them like a garden of flowers, looking for things to recognize, and recognize he did. He collected his own pseudepigrapha from everywhere. He explains, such study as this is a quote from Hugh now, as has been done shows us that the old myths are by no means pure fiction any more than they are all history. Myths arise as attempts to explain rituals whose meaning has been forgotten. So when the ancient myths from all over the world show us the same situation and the same adventures recurring again and again, we may look upon this endless repetition not as discrediting the historicity of those events, but confirming it. There is no telling what wonders may be brought to light simply by bringing together new combinations and associations of documents already in our possession. You can kind of hear his way of doing his research that I read you at the beginning from 1951. You know, he's going to look at what they say, but then he's going to look at what they don't say, and then he's going to find out if it needs to be said. That's what I got out of his way of operating. It appears that the ancient myths, wherever they turn up, have a tendency to fit together into the same picture, supporting and confirming each other due to the solid ground on which they stand, the reality of ritual. This leads us to believe that there is a serious historical reality behind the myths as a whole. Now, I remember his saying this to us in different ways in class. This open attitude gave me confidence as I researched my thesis on Melchizedek. I was excited to examine the Genesis Apocryphon from the Dead Sea Scrolls, Cave 1, for bits of tradition that corresponded with the truths I had already discovered in Alma 13, which added considerably to my knowledge of Melchizedek. I also consulted the Nag Hammadi Melchizedek document, which had not yet been published and was kindly supplied me by the scholar who had barely translated it. I would never have thought to do that if I hadn't had those classes from Hugh Nibley. I would have been just working in materials that everybody knew about. And instead of that, I was out there on the edge with him. I mean, Nag Hammadi had not even come to light much yet. In fact, a year later, after my thesis was already published, his name starts with a B, wrote me a note and said, the Melchizedek document is now published, if you'd like, and sent me a copy of it. Nibley teaches us that the key to benefiting from searching tradition and myths is starting from a solid base of truth, but ranging far afield and looking is the very essence of the search of a true observer. The question always is, what matches? What corresponds? What is out in left field? I can't remember if it's Truman or Hugh that used to say, oh, that's out in left field, meaning that we're not going to touch that. That's not anything that we want to know about. He went far afield from the Apocrypha in the canonized or body of known and accepted pseudepigrapha, finding his own documents in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in Nag Hammadi, at Ebla, and unlocking them as they appeared on the scene with the key of language and myth gathering, but always avoiding left field. He had a game plan, and he stuck to it. Is that a mix? Did I ruined that metaphor, you know, I just kind of kept going with it. Okay, number 9, he looked at Enoch and Abraham. He taught us, quote, Zion is a code word denoting a very real thing. Zion is any community in which the celestial order prevails. And then the prophets through the Old Testament designate this world by the code name of Babylon. It was Babylon where Abraham dwelt and came out of. He said dwelt, and I said and came out of. He looked long at Abraham. That is the understatement of the evening. He never stopped looking, and he wrote much to fill us in on this remarkable patriarch. Among other things, he said, Abraham remains throughout eternity preeminently the friend of man, the kind father, husband, and host, the earnest and self-effacing advocate, the rescue worker, the zealous missionary, and finally, the devoted worker for the dead. Almost all of those titles would come from other sources than our scriptures. There'd be hints of them in all of our scriptures, but a lot of them he colored in the picture. Can we really speak of Hugh Nibley and the Bible without more about Enoch and Abraham, especially Abraham? As surely as Abraham was the friend of God, so surely was Hugh Nibley the friend of Abraham. He opened Abraham to us in ways never before attempted or even conceived, collecting that untapped treasure of myth and treasure and tradition, excuse me, to paint a larger, more complete picture. But we could safely save Abraham for Michael Rhodes on April 8th. When I realized that his whole thing is going to be Abraham, I thought, I don't. In any way, try to go through the Abraham literature. It would only take you maybe 5-6 years of full-time reading. I didn't have quite that much time. Among my favorite moments with Hugh Nibley was the time he told us the same story about Abraham that he tells at the end of his DVD. I remember his eyes filling with tears at both tellings. I am so grateful for the images of Hugh in Egypt, sitting at sunset with the heat swirling around him, a wise, white-haired, aging patriarch himself, telling a tender tale of the great patriarch Abraham, a story from outside the box. I repeat it here from that source. We must do the works of Abraham, says Brother Nibley, and then we are told specifically in the Doctrine and Covenants that that means sacrificing, if necessary, your own life. Abraham was willing to do that. Unless you are willing to give everything, you cannot claim eternal life. It's not to be cheaply bought. These are the great blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There's a story told in the Midrash. It begins with, and this is still Brother Nibley, it begins with Abraham sitting in the door of his tent in the plain of Mamre in the heat of the day. But this was a hot day, like the one where Hugh is telling the story. Beautiful filmmaking. You can see I don't know if it was really, if they could do that. I think, could they do that? Could they make it look like heat? Filmmaker friend? Okay, well, somebody made it look like heat. But it looks like that when you're in Egypt. I've been there many times, and you can see it's really hot. We used to always look for a pillar to stand by, anything to stand by that had any kind of shadow. You can see the kind of country it is, the heat and the dust and the sand. That's utter desolation. And he was worried, of course, because he says some poor stranger might be lost out there. Someone might have lost his way and be perishing because you're not going to last an hour in this. And that is absolutely true. People die on the deserts, on the Negev, on the deserts in Israel, in 3 hours without water, they die. So he sent his faithful servant Eleazar to look everywhere. He sent him out in all directions, and he came back. No, I can't find anyone anywhere. Abraham was still worried. He said, there might be someone out there. You have these feelings. So he went out himself, though he was very sick at the time. He was sick and ailing and old. And he went out into that hell, and he looked and searched, but he found no one. And at the end of the day, he came back exhausted toward his tent. As he approached the tent, the three strangers were standing there. It was the Lord and the two with him, because the Lord goes with two counselors, so to speak, he says. He threw himself down on his face, and then it is that the Lord promised him Isaac as a reward for what he had done, this supreme offering. It's a very moving story. Abraham said, I think I can find someone. Well, he found something. He found the answer to the thing he'd prayed for all his life, his son Isaac. It's a beautiful story. This Abraham, this is still him, who towers like a colossus, is every man as every man should be. How much did you know about Abraham before Hunibly? You can answer that in your heart. I mean, I think any one of us is affected by all the things he brought to us about Abraham. He looked at Enoch. He said the purpose of the book of Enoch was to show God is not cruel. A word about Enoch, a word from Hugh, that is, from 1975 to 1977 series in the Ensign called A Strange Thing in the Land, all about the book of Enoch. I had just completed my graduate work in ancient studies, which had included my classes from Hugh Nibley. What an introduction to this series. I ate it up. It was like a delicious dessert, and I was ready for it, steeped in what I had already learned from this great teacher. It was like a continuation of the courses he taught. In fact, I remember how excited I was to learn about all the books of Enoch and the detail of Mahijah. But let Hugh tell the tale. I don't know, you can go online and find every one of those just on our church website, on lds.org. And then go to, what did I go to? Search for a thing, a strange thing in the land. And it will bring you all 13 of those. And you can read them, download them, look at them, do whatever you want with them. What a blessing. Anyway, and the thing that was interesting about them, I downloaded several of them, but the thing that was interesting was that they were written, not the prose part, but the examples looked exactly like a learned treatise, like something that was put in the journals of religion, you know, with two columns, with the Pearl of Great Price Enoch, and then all of these other columns with the other Enochs that he had found. And then this is what he says about Mahijah, and it was Mahijah that got me so excited. I can remember so clearly how I felt when I read that. Really fascinating. What always impressed me is the oddest detail of the Joseph Smith account of Enoch, this is Hugh talking, was the appearance out of the blue of the name of the only non-biblical individual named in the whole book, Mahijah, Moses 6 and 40. Mahijah is the one who asks Enoch searching questions, and in answer is told about the place Mahujah, which for Hebrew that makes no difference. It's just different vowels. Am I right? Please correct me if I say anything really stupid, okay? Where Enoch began this particular phase of his mission. That's the Mahijah the person, Mahujah the place, Mahuya. Moses 7 and 2. It was therefore with a distinct shock of recognition that after having looked through all but the last of the Aramaic Enoch fragments, this is outside of the box, without finding anything particularly new and coming to those very last little fragments, I found the name Mahuja leaping out of the pages again and again. And then he lists page 300, 302 to 5, 311, 314. Here was this name. Could this be our Mahuja or Mahija? As a matter of fact, it could be either. Not only because the semi-vowels are written very much alike in the Aramaic script. This, you're going to really love this part. And are sometimes confused by scribes. But also because the name as written in 4QEN, MHWY, is the same as the, I don't know what those stand for. If I knew, I would say them. Who appears in Genesis 4:18 as the grandfather of Enoch, transliterated in the King James Bible as Mahuja El, with El added at the end, which is very common in the Old Testament, which name appears in the Greek Septuagint as Ma'i-El, and in the Latin Vulgate as Mavia-El, showing that Mahuja and Mahija were the same name. I'm sure that's convincing to you. So you think language helps? Here he uses English, Greek, Latin, Aramaic, and Hebrew. Now imagine, he comes on a name, and because he knows the other languages, he knows what it would be. He knows how it would be written there. It wouldn't look the same. I mean, this even happens to us just with Hebrew. It's easy. You see something, you think, oh, that's the same as this, even though the vowels may be different. But he continues, so what? A coincidence? A giant or a watcher called Mahuja or Mahija? But far more than a coincidence when taken in its context. The only thing the Mahija in the book of Moses is remarkable for is putting a bold direct questions to Enoch, thus giving the patriarch an opening for calling upon the people to repent, referring them to the book of remembrance and telling them of the plan of salvation. And this is exactly the role and the only role that the Aramaic Mahuja plays in the story. It is peculiar to the version Joseph Smith gave us and the oldest known Enoch manuscripts. I don't know how you feel about that. I think that's... And then he says, the following translation, which he is going to list below with in columns with Moses, our pearl of great price, the following translation is from Millikan Black, lest the writer be charged with forcing the text. How playful he was. He ignored critics. This is not to say he didn't sometimes pen answers to them, but they never deterred him. He went blissfully on his way, being about his own business, or more precisely, his father's business. We could all take a page from his book. Spending this time with him again these past few weeks has been a delight, just as every encounter always was. I come away again truly humbled, realizing how little I know and what treasures there are to learn. The potential of one day having our capacities expanded to know all things seems more of a reality because of him. I think the soaring words of DNC 76 truly fit. For thus saith the Lord, I, the Lord, am merciful and gracious unto those who fear me and delight to honor those who serve me in righteousness and in truth unto the end. Great shall be the reward, and eternal shall be their glory. And to them will I reveal all mysteries, yea, all the hidden mysteries of my kingdom, from days of old and for ages to come, will I make known unto them the good pleasure of my will concerning all things pertaining to my kingdom. Yea, even the wonders of eternity shall they know, and things to come will I show them, even the things of many generations. And their wisdom shall be great, and their understanding reach to heaven. And before them the wisdom of the wise shall perish, and the understanding of the prudent shall come to naught. For by my spirit I will enlighten them, and by my power will I make known unto them the secrets of my will, yea, even those things which eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor yet entered into the heart of man. I want to say thank you, Hugh. After all is said and done about Hugh Nibley and the Bible, it is his faith we need to emulate. The faith of this extraordinary observer. It was from his heart that he chose to range abroad after obtaining all the tools he might need in the search. No one knows what he knows now. Joseph Smith once said, "Could you gaze into heaven 5 minutes, you would know more than you would by reading all that was ever written on the subject." No one ever entered the spirit world or heaven more curious and prepared to satiate his curiosity than Hugh Winder Nibley. It is a wonderful thing to think of him, no more a stranger, looking wherever the angels direct, pondering and recognizing everything. Thank you.